You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 216 by Rudolf Steiner, 8 Lectures, translated by Paul King, entitled Supersensible Impulses in the Historical Development of Humanity. This is the last lecture in this cycle, Lecture 8, given in Dornach on the 1st of October, 1922. In our last session, we looked at certain comprehensive impulses in the historical development of humankind. For our look at history, these comprehensive impulses must serve our knowledge like shining stars that can shed light on separate events that have happened during the course of humanity's development. Unless we are able to feel and perceive the impulses that lie behind it, we can only get to know each historical age in a very external way. These impulses have effects. The effects operate chiefly and most strongly in the unconscious forces of the human soul. And what plays out externally in people's consciousness is seen in its proper light only when we are able to trace it back to these impulses. Let's take a well-known historical event, an event or rather a sequence of events, that was deeply incisive in the Christian West in the middle of the Middle Ages. It was a sequence of events that, externally speaking, was over relatively quickly, after one or one and a half centuries. In its effect, however, for one who is able to understand the deeper currents of world history, it has continued even into the present day. Let's take the events of the Crusades, which began in the 11th century, the year 1096 is the time usually given, and stretched externally to the year 1270, or so it is accepted. We see that even external history cites how the events of the Crusades had a broad effect in shaping aspects of life. The Knights Templar are cited, for example, who became significant for outer life during the Crusades. Religious orders are cited, like the Knights of St. John, the later Knights of Malta, and others. And what had its beginning in a pervasive mood for crusading within these communal and spiritual fellowships developed later such that its origin in this crusading mood receives scant mention. But its effects in Western Christian life were distinctly evident. Looking initially at external history, we know that the Crusades came about because those Christian members of the Occident who believed in refreshing their Christian impulse by crusading again and again to Palestine began to encounter resistance when Jerusalem came into the hands of a very different people, the Turkish people. Pilgrims traveling to Jerusalem found themselves mistreated by these Turkish people, and this situation led to a general complaint in Europe. We see how, out of this general complaint, the crusading mood, which had long been present in other ways, now expressed itself in people coming together and demanding that the holy sites of the Orient, Christian sites, be freed from Turkish dominance. We are told how Peter of Amiens, who had experienced this Turkish dominance himself, made pilgrimages around Western Europe, and how by his heartfelt speeches won the hearts of many who then wanted to set out for Jerusalem and free it from the affliction of the Turks. But we know that this initially failed, and that the First Crusade subsequently came about through a large number of knights of the Occident coming together under the leadership of Godfrey of Bouillon, who then did indeed manage to free Jerusalem from the Turks, albeit only temporarily. We only need look up these events. They are well known to external history. But it is a matter also of looking inwardly with real understanding at what was at work more or less unconsciously in these souls, so that over such a long period, large numbers of people continued, in part in an exceptionally devout and courageous manner, to undertake these seven crusades to the Orient under the leadership of the most eminent princes of the Occident. Above all, we must ask ourselves where the enthusiasm for the crusades came from, which was so prevalent in European life when the crusades began. Later, once the business, if I might express it thus, was underway, already from the Fourth Crusade onward, other interests certainly got mixed in with the affair. European princes traveled to the Orient for completely different reasons, for prestige, for example, to consolidate their power and such like. Nevertheless, the beginning of the Crusades constitutes an exceptionally significant historical event. It is exceptionally significant, historically speaking, when we look at the tremendous urge that suddenly gripped a large section of the populace of all classes in Europe to undertake something which for European humanity was tied in the holiest way to a matter of the heart. But people felt that this most sacred matter of the heart was connected with liberating Jerusalem from the Turks, with making it possible for European Christians to have a free route, once more, to the gravesite of their Redeemer. When dry historical facts are related or read about in books, we generally do not feel the tremendous fire that raged through Europe at that time, as noble knights undertook the First Crusade, or as Bernard of Clairvaux and others fanned the fire of the trend by the inwardness and fire of their own souls. There is something of tremendous greatness in the initial emergence of these crusades. And we feel obliged to ask, what sort of impulses are at work here in European hearts, in European souls, impulses that eventually led to the crusading spirit? We can only understand these impulses properly when we trace how they have developed over the centuries. What I should like to call a crossroads in the historical development of Europe, where a great deal of what later became so important and decisive was already evident, such a crossroads of European development is the reign of Pope Nicholas I, around the middle of the 9th century. Nicholas I, who reigned from 858 to 867, was the Roman Pope who saw, rising before his soul, three spiritual streams like great question marks, I should like to say, of civilization. One of these streams moved as though at a kind of spiritual altitude from Asia to Europe. We can say that this stream carries forward the religious knowledge of the Orient in a very modified and changed form over the south of Europe, over the north of Africa, to Spain, to France, to the British Isles, and especially to Ireland. We can take its point of origin to be the Arabian area of Asia. It then travels to Greece, Italy, but also through Africa, into Spain and to the West, but also radiates in different ways over the rest of Europe. External history barely mentions this stream. It actually contains a huge amount, but today we will look at only two aspects of it. One of the things living in this stream is something we could call an esoteric understanding of the mystery of Golgotha. I have often mentioned how the mystery of Golgotha was perceived by those who had preserved a remnant of the old initiation knowledge from the times before the mystery of Golgotha. We can see this even in the Bible itself, in the coming of the three magi or kings from the east. Out of the secrets of the starry worlds, these magi sensed and sought the Christ event. They thus belonged primarily to those who knew little of the earthly person of Jesus of Nazareth, but for whom the important fact was that a spiritual being, the Christ, had taken up residence in the body of Jesus of Nazareth, and was to exert an impulse for the more distant evolution of the earth. Souls such as these saw the event of Golgotha in a completely supersensory way, and this supersensory perception could only take place in souls in whom the ancient initiation principles had been preserved. For with the aid of these initiation principles, things could be understood which cannot be understood in the natural and historical earthly world. within these initiation principles, this purely supersensory event could be understood. Over the course of time, however, it became increasingly difficult to retain these ancient initiation principles, and thus it became less and less possible to find a means of expression when one wanted to say how Christ descended from worlds beyond the earth and accomplished the mystery of Golgotha in such a way that his activity works on in the earth's historical development. People simply did not have the possibility of shaping their concepts, of configuring their ideas, such that they were enabled to find words in an ideal form to say what happened through Christ with the aid of the mystery of Golgotha. Thus, in order to express this mystery, it became increasingly necessary to resort to depictions using imagery. One such pictorial depiction is the story of the Holy Grail, the precious chalice from which it is said, on the one hand, that Christ Jesus and his apostles took their Last Supper, and on the other hand, that it is the same chalice in which the blood of the Redeemer was collected by the Roman soldier at the foot of the cross. The chalice is then carried by angels to Mont Salvat. You see, supersensory things are alluded to, and people say in stammering words what the ancient initiates would still have been able to express in clearly contoured concepts, and which one could only express now by resorting to images. So, angels carried the chalice over to the Spanish mountain Montsalvat, where it was received by the noble King Titurel. He founded a temple dedicated to the chalice, where the knights of the Holy Grail lived in order to watch over and preserve what is actually the stronghold for the continued working of the impulse that emanated from the mystery of Golgotha. Thus we have something that leads to a mystery, a deeply esoteric stream. We see on the one hand how schools are founded over in Asia, where the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle is studied, and which try to understand the event of Golgotha using the Greek concepts of Aristotle. We see how, later, in a poetical work such as Parsifal, an attempt is made out of European civilization to encompass in pictorial words what was living in this stream. We see how everything that lived in this stream illumines and suffuses the teachings that emerged particularly in the schools of Ireland. We see how the best of what the Arabs produced is poured into this stream, but how at that same time an alien element is also introduced by the Arabs, which had been particularly coarsened and barbarized in Asia by the Turkish element. We'll discuss the character this stream assumed through the Arabs, through its ever-advancing progress from east to west, when we have looked at the other stream. But if we wanted to state the fundamental nature of this stream, we should have to characterize it roughly as follows. Those who lived in some way in this stream saw all salvation, and we can see this echoed in Wolfram von Eschenbach's Parsifal, in lifting oneself up from the sensory to the supersensory, in having at least an approximate perception of the supersensory worlds, in letting human beings partake in the supersensory worlds, and letting them know that their soul belongs to a stream that cannot be directly perceived if one's senses are turned toward earthly events. This was its curious characteristic, namely this gazing up into extraterrestrial supersensory regions. This sense that if a human being wishes to be a complete human being, they must belong to worlds that hover, as it were, above the sensory world of nature, and in which events take place that are as hidden from external eyes, like the deeds of the Grail Knights. The mystery that flowed in this stream was not to be seen with external eyes. This was the one stream which flowed very quietly in the 9th century, but which was seen as hostile in the Rome where Nicholas I was Pope. The mood in Rome definitely viewed this stream as something inimical, as something that was actually unwholesome for Western people if they got involved with it. There was to be nothing in the religion or thought life of Europe of an esoteric nature, nor anything derived from esotericism. Without doubt, this was the first and most terrible question mark for Nicholas I. He still sensed the greatness of the spiritual life in this dream that had faded significantly since the 3rd or 4th century. In Italy, they had even founded societies for the eradication of all spiritual paths of knowledge, but which nevertheless had shown via various secret paths into the hearts of people and become evident here and there. What often broke through into the experience of human souls from mysterious underground depths of world historic events was denounced as heresy. One had the feeling that Roman Latin culture had developed in such a way that its concepts, which had moved increasingly away from former Greek and Oriental inwardness to Roman Latin rhetoric, in other words, toward a certain superficiality, were no longer able to absorb but was still faintly alive in the fading esotericism. But on the other hand, something extraordinarily powerful was rising up in individual people and in communities which were denounced as sects. The second question mark Nicholas I faced in the world historic context was this, that based on all the experience the Catholic Church had gathered hitherto, he had to regard the population of the European West as unsuited to bear the highly spiritual tension that arises in people's souls when they are required to work their way up in the described manner to spiritual esoteric understanding. We could say that a great doubt settled in the soul of Nicholas I, namely, what would happen if too much of this esoteric spiritual stream got into European souls? What was in the Orient became more and more confused itself. Actually, it was only this one stream, which stretched all the way to Ireland, that remained the most pure. And for a time in Ireland, there were indeed spiritual schools that preserved the sacred secrets of this stream in great purity. But now Nicholas I told himself that this was not something for the European populace. He basically only wanted the same thing that Bonifaci had wanted somewhat differently, who had regarded the European populace as unsuited to absorb spiritual life into their souls. And the curious thing was that the actual esoteric content in the Orient began to melt away. The people in the Orient, including the European Orient, toward present-day Russia, were unable to connect their souls with this esoteric spiritual content. But they had a sense of it, at least to the extent that this sense was not thoroughly driven out of them by the advancing Turanian peoples that then emerged as the Turks. The people of the East had a dim, indistinct feeling that everything of a high esoteric nature, and which could not be grasped by people's emerging intellect, flowed and streamed into religious worship. But only when, at the same time, the rites of worship had a real external center, a geographical center, as it were. Thus in Eastern Europe, where things of a real esoteric and spiritual nature had been forgotten, there arose an inclination toward religious worship, but with a tremendous leaning toward what people felt to be the focal point of their worship, with a leaning toward the grave of the Redeemer. There at the grave of the Redeemer in Jerusalem was the site where the Redeemer, together with his apostles, had first celebrated the Last Supper, that Last Supper which then in its further metamorphoses became the death on Golgotha, had been fulfilled by the death on Golgotha, and then lived on in the central service of the Mass and other church ceremonies. And as people became alienated from the real spiritual element, because they did not rise up to an esoteric understanding, in their hearts people turned to religious worship and to what was associated with this worship, to the Redeemer's grave, to the place in Jerusalem. Making the pilgrimage to Jerusalem was seen as the crowning, we might say, of the ceremonial services that could be conducted at other places. All the ceremonies and rituals that could be conducted at various separate places were to find a crowning point for the individual person by taking what they had experienced as a copied image in the ceremonial form and permeating it with their heart by going on a one-time pilgrimage themselves to the grave of the Redeemer. Concepts which the ancient Egyptians developed with enormous coercive power, as I discussed when we looked at mummification, could still be understood by certain schools over in Asia, but were lost to the populace. People could not lift themselves to what is the mystery of the human being, nor, therefore, to the mystery of the divine world as well. The more the period of Pope Nicholas I progressed, the more one saw in the East an inward, heart-oriented reverence for religious worship, and an inward, heart-oriented inclination toward the working together of worship, and everything one could experience and feel through worship on the one hand, and what one felt on the other to be the crowning of these feelings, the greatest act of worship, the pilgrimage to the Holy Grave. When one looked eastward from the Rome of the 9th century, from the Rome of Pope Nicholas I, one saw something that Nicholas I and his advisers considered to be inappropriate for Central and Western Europeans. They deemed these Central and Western European populations to have too much of the intellect flooding into human development, to be inclined to gaze at mere ceremonies, albeit ones inwardly suffused with heart, or to journey to the Holy Grave. European humanity had too much of emerging intellectualism to be able to be a complete human being in this way. One saw that this was possible in the East, but could not be expected from the humanity of Central and Western Europe. On the other side, one also saw the first question mark. It was seen as an enormous threat that what was in this stream that contained so much esotericism, so much of what can actually only be fully comprehended with spiritualized ideas, might be brought to Europe. And so, if I may put it like this, when they looked westward from the Rome of Pope Nicholas I, they saw a threat. And when they looked eastward, they also saw a threat. In the East, they saw a spreading stream, or actually a series of streams, coming deep into Europe. The stream of esoteric worship, in contrast to the other esoteric stream. On no account could either this stream or the other be allowed to take hold in Central Europe, so said the papal court of Nicholas I. So what was to be done? The spiritual content beheld by the proper adherents of this esoteric stream had to be rendered into dogmatic form. They had to have words, sentences for it. It had to be uttered. But they had to prevent people from seeing and understanding what they uttered. And thus arose the notion of faith. The idea came about that one must give people in abstract and dogmatic form a content they can believe in, but without them having the possibility of beholding it. And thus there arose a third stream which took hold of Central and Western Europe in both its religion and its science, and gave the strongly emerging intellect dogma, but not in a way that this dogma might have been vision rendered into concepts, but dogma such that was merely spoken. People no longer beheld what the dogma represented. They were just supposed to believe it. Had this esoteric stream, which stretched as far as Ireland and faded away in the new era, been properly pursued, the people involved in it would have had to engage in a union of soul with the spiritual world. For, fundamentally speaking, what was living in this esoteric stream was the great question: how can human beings orient themselves in the etheric world, in the etheric cosmos? For what was beheld, including the mystery of Golgotha, in the way I described earlier, was related to the etheric element of the cosmos. So we could say, here was the great question concerning the attributes of the etheric cosmos. But for the central stream, the stream that right into the Middle Ages predominantly took the form of Latin culture, what was related to the etheric cosmos was turned into the content of dogma. In the West, there was the unconscious question about the mystery of the etheric cosmos. In the East, the great question that arose was, what is the situation with regard to the etheric organization, with the human etheric organism? In all the feeling and knowledge that flowed in the cultus, ceremony, and ritual of the East, there lived the unconscious question, what is our proper relationship to our etheric body? In the southwesterly stream, there lived the question, what is our proper relationship to the etheric cosmos? Previously, human beings had obtained truths about the supersensory world quite naturally through a dreamlike clairvoyance. They did not need to become aware of the etheric in the world or in themselves. This is what was so significant in the new era, that the question arose for people concerning the content of the etheric. In the West, the question concerning the etheric cosmos. In the East, the question concerning one's own etheric body. The question of the etheric cosmos calls human beings to the highest development of their mental spiritual activity. They must develop the strongest power of ideas in order to penetrate into the mysteries of the cosmos. I indicated yesterday how we first find these when we look in a Goethean way at the metamorphosis of the plant, but then rise to the comprehensive metamorphosis that leads from one earthly life to the next. But in Rome, particularly at the time of Pope Nicholas I, this was seen as dangerous. What was living in this stream had to be filled in and covered over. But the other stream, the Eastern stream, also consisted of an examination of the etheric, but only of the etheric element in one's own organism, with one's own human etheric body. The human physical body lives together with everything that is expressed in the external kingdoms of nature, with animals, plants, minerals. The human physical body lives with all our man-made machines. But if we want to live here on earth with our etheric body, we can only do so in an external way by living in ceremonies, in ritual. When we live in events that are not real in an earthly, sensory sense. People in the East wanted to live in such events in order to experience the inner attributes of their own etheric organism. In 9th century Rome of Pope Nicholas I, this too was deemed unsuitable for Europe. What was preserved from the West and then spread even farther west so that this esoteric stream was completely concealed, was only what the intellect could produce in the form of dogma, where supersensory truths could now only be a matter of faith and no longer be held. But the inner relationship to ritual worship that had developed in Eastern Europe was also deemed unsuitable for the people of Central and Western Europe, and hence there arose the particular form of religious rites that we have in the Roman Catholic Church. If you compare the form of worship in the Eastern and Russian Orthodox Church with the way worship is conducted in the Roman Catholic Church, you find the following difference. In the Roman Catholic Church, it is more a symbol that people look at, whereas in the East, it is more something that the soul lives into with full ardor. The constant need in the West was to look away from the form of worship, which had become associated with dogmatic thinking, and to turn to dogma itself as a means of elucidating this ritual. In the East, the form of worship itself had effect. And what went toward the West finally confined itself to gradually becoming what was preserved in an external way in various occult brotherhoods, which still exist today and even play a significant role, but which have been stripped of all the esotericism of ancient times. How to inaugurate a form of worship that did not penetrate as deeply into people's etheric nature as it did in the East, and how to establish a dogmatic theology that would relieve people of having to direct their vision to the spiritual world, how to establish this double stream was the third great question Mark facing Nicholas I. and he worked at it. As a consequence, it happened that the Greek Oriental Church separated completely from the Roman Catholic Church. The real inner reasons for this lie in what I have just related. Everything I have discussed here was clearly present deep down in souls at the time of the reign of Pope Nicholas I, in the middle of the 9th Christian century. There were also definitely remnants of esotericism in the West. There were esoteric schools, particularly in Spain, France, and Ireland. There were individuals who could look into the spiritual worlds and who also had a form of Christianity whose teachings were based on vision. The vision that existed there was later preserved only in hinted-at glimpses of the Holy Grail that kept surfacing in mysterious ways, or of its worldly counterpart, the Round Table of King Arthur. But people had the feeling that it was connected with a vision of supersensible worlds, with an experience of worlds beyond the earth. In Central Europe and extending into those places in the West, where esotericism could still be found, there lived the result of an inner dogmatic theology based on faith, associated with a world of ceremonial that was not completely connected with the human etheric body. And, in the East, there lived what I have described. When we describe the European soul in the 9th century, we have everywhere to characterize these three moods of soul in diverse variations. Everything else that is spoken about in history is just a fleeting external impression of what is going on in the depths. But now came the times that followed. The times came when what had become increasingly externalized in Arabism was added, as it were, to this esoteric stream. We might say that what Aristotelianism had become over in the East also flowed into it. And this later influence caused this esoteric stream, which had originated in a very spiritual view, to become materialistic. And we see that already in the 11th, 12th century, for example, esotericism was fading more and more, melting away, and that this esoteric stream assumed the materialistic form of thinking, which, in a later metamorphosis, became the materialism in natural science, for it actually has its roots in Arabism. The central stream, the actual creation of Pope Nicholas I, which had already been nourished by Boniface and had found significant support in the Merovingians and the Carolingians and had been influenced very little down the centuries by the Grail and other holy legends that directed human souls to the supersensory world, this central stream came closer and closer in its forms of worship and its theological dogma to a materialistic view. From the purer perceptions, for example, of the transubstantiation that people had had in earlier times, and of the process of the Mass, and so on, there developed that crass materialistic view which was the only thing that could have led to people starting to argue about the Last Supper. Disputations over the Last Supper were proof that people no longer understood it as it had originally been understood. We can only understand it when it is suffused with a recognition of the Spirit. Thus this Western, East, South, Western stream became materialistic. The central stream became materialistic, and the Eastern stream, too, in its essential nature, became increasingly materialistic. The tide of materialism was rising, and yet humanity, nevertheless, everywhere resisted this tide of materialism in a certain way. And now we move from the 9th century of Pope Nicholas I to the 11th century. We must really picture how an individuality such as Pope Nicholas I was faced with these three question marks, like three terrible, soul-tormenting powers. For unlike the situation in later congresses, where lines were drawn on a map according to external circumstances, he couldn't say, "I order a border to be put here and here." He couldn't do this, because souls cannot be limited in this way. He could only give directions, as it were, and give the middle direction a particular emphasis. Nicholas I was a genius at giving the Central European stream this particular emphasis. And yet it nevertheless came about, for example, that the mood in the East reached far into the West. It was a mood that ignited the inner ardor of the human etheric organism by means of the sacred rituals of worship, and which at the same time, but now in a more Western European way, connected the process of these sacred rituals with the center in Jerusalem. The spirit of pilgrimage, of the cross, that reached from the East into Central Europe and toward the West, this orientation toward an actual focal point, could be preached a little by a Peter of Amiens, and then with a really dazzling passion by a Bernard of Clairvaux. And into the pilgrimage movement in Europe was mixed what remained of the stream from the Western aspect via the culture of the Grail and of Arthur. What remained when the esotericism had run out and the human being was left with the outer form, the human being for whom the earth was not actually the earth, but a particular location in the whole cosmos. A view such as this was indeed prevalent among the knights of Western and Central Europe, which then associated itself with the spirit of the Crusades. And into this was mixed, initially only like a muted undertone, but growing stronger and stronger as the Crusades proceeded, what Nicholas I had founded in religion and knowledge as the actual spirit of European civilization. This is why the Crusades appear as something we can simply no longer fully understand out of the later circumstances. For the central stream then spread, the East European stream remained alongside it and was regarded within Europe as a backward religious stream. The West European stream has metamorphosed into the various branches of occult esotericism, into all kinds of occult brotherhoods, Masonic orders, and so on. The middle stream was finally also captured by science, in scholasticism, in modern natural science. A person who sees only what happened in the modern era will not be able to comprehend the spirit of the Crusades. The spirit of the Crusades is only comprehensible to someone who can see the impulse that was living from the 4th or 5th to the 12th or 13th Christian centuries, and what Pope Nicholas I had sensed particularly strongly in the question, how do we connect what is living in external events of the world that are directed by human beings themselves, the chief of which is the form of religious worship, with the living stream of spiritual life, the life of spiritual beings? We might say that for European people, beginning in the 9th, 10th, 11th century, just as the realities of religious ritual had to fall away on the one hand, so the realities of spiritual vision fell away on the other. While the realities of religious ritual disappeared into the indefinite quality of Asia and were covered over by the Turks' conquest of the holy site with which, for Christians, the actions of ritual worship were associated, so with the discovery of America, the esoteric mysteries of the Western streams fell, figuratively speaking, into the Atlantic Ocean. As a reaction to this, a mood arose that asked, how do we fill these things that have to be, the holy rituals and their center, the site in Jerusalem, how do we fill these with spiritual life? If you read the speeches of Bernard of Clairvaux, you can still feel today how there speaks out of him a fervent attachment to the ritual of worship, to the external sensory side in which esotericism is living, and how, on the other hand, his heart is fired up with what had once lived in the esoteric mood of the West. What sounds into the speeches and sermons of Bernard of Clairvaux, even if he doesn't utter it expressly, but lets it be heard in the grandeur of his artistic expression, is what the etheric cosmos wishes to reveal to human beings, but can no longer reveal. At the same time, it is what wishes to work from the earth in one's own human etheric organism. This is what drove people to Asia, to seek once more for what they had lost toward the West. The driving impulse, nevertheless, was esotericism, People wanted to catch sight of what they had lost toward the West by making a connection once more to the Redeemer's grave. The tragedy of the subsequent time lay in the fact that people had not grasped and couldn't hear, for example, what then became the mood in Rosicrucianism, I mean in its true form, that wished to seek Christ in spiritual heights, not at a physical grave. But the time has now come when humanity must comprehend that just as those who came to the grave after the death of the Redeemer were told, quote, "He whom you seek is no longer here, seek him elsewhere," close quote, so the Crusaders too were told, quote, "He whom you seek is no longer here, seek him elsewhere," close quote. Today the time has come when we must look elsewhere for him who is no longer there, when we must seek him by opening up anew to the spiritual worlds. This is the task facing people of the present. This is what I wanted to add to our considerations of the last few days. And I should not fail to take this opportunity, following on from what I have tried, albeit very sketchily, to draw out of anthroposophical esotericism, to say that in the souls who are members of the Anthroposophical Society and who wish to affirm anthroposophy, there may be a sense of the tremendous significance of the present historical moment, of the significance of seeking the spiritual worlds. And following on from the incisive things I have looked at here, I should like to say, within the separate circles of the Anthroposophical Society, may people try to become aware of the seriousness of the present historical moment, and ask themselves in the circumstances whether it would be possible to galvanize the Anthroposophical Society in a certain sense, so that it could get away from a certain sleepiness and awaken to real life. Today, where significant things in the fields of science and practical life are supposed to emerge from the Anthroposophical Society, we need this Anthroposophical Society, in the broadest sense, to be composed of souls that are alert and inwardly alive, who are ignited by insight to the importance of the historical moment. If at all possible, ask yourselves and others whether it would be possible in the near future to galvanize the old Anthroposophical Society and add life to it from the life of its individual souls. This would be necessary. Become skillful. That is also a possibility. But the souls who wish to ignite their life through insight into the important historic moment must come together on our ground. Do for the anthroposophical movement what many have more or less forgotten to do for it in recent times. And that is the end of Lecture 8 and the end of the book, Supersensible Impulses in the Historical Development of Humanity, translated by Paul King, number 216 in the Collected Works volume.